J-Files on Double J.
Hey, Gemma Pike here, and this is the J-Files podcast. Every week, we dive into the Double J archives to find the hidden gems, the long-lost interviews, the stories behind how some of your favourite music was made. And this week, I was literally handed the most incredible gift. So I work with Richard Kingsmill. We share an office together. And when we were chatting about doing a J-Files on Kate Bush, he said, oh, hang on one second. I think I've got a file on her. And he disappeared for about 10 minutes and came back holding this yellow manila folder that had aged from sitting in some cabinet somewhere for many, many years. It was 1996 that he did a J-Files on Kate Bush, and he handed me this folder and said, oh, here, you know, here's some notes. I think you might want to have a little bit of a look over them before you do the show. And when I opened them up, it was all of his handwritten notes about what he was going to do with the show. The quiz was in there, G from Cairns, and then I think it was Julia from St Kilda. They went head to head, five questions each. I think it was G who ended up winning the quiz back in the day at that time. And it was just the most incredible archival nugget of gold. I felt so privileged holding onto it because I obviously love and respect Kingsmill so much. And it was just really magical to be able to hold on to the first incarnation of the Kate Bush J-Files and then be able to turn around and make a new one 22 years on. So in those files, he and Chris Norris, the producer, had put together this really special piece of archival history. And I thought, why don't we just play it for you? So what you're about to hear was put together the good old-fashioned way. This was pre-computers. So Richard actually said that Chris transcribed everything. He cut up pieces of paper. He laid it all out. And then he put it all together for the radio using tape machines and splicing tape. So here is this really special piece by Richard Kingsmill and Chris Norris for the original Kate Bush J-Files in 1996.
Hello, everyone out there. This is Kate Bush in London. I'm on 2JJ having a great time. I hope you're all listening and I hope you're well.
When Kate Bush burst onto the international music scene in early 1978, it was like she appeared out of thin air. But it had all been a long time coming for the 20-year-old English girl with the voice of an angel. Aged 11 at St Joseph's School in Bexley, south of London, Kathy Bush first took up music studies with the violin.
And it was very useful for me, actually. I really did get some good things like music theory. That was very important for me.
She was a shy girl, writing poetry for the school magazine and setting her words to music using an old harmonium her parents kept in the barn. Music was a passion in the Bush household, with her two older brothers, John and Paddy.
And they were very into traditional music, traditional English and Irish music. And it was around me all the time, you know, like you'd hear it coming from the top room down the stairs. And I just used to sing along with them, and it seemed a very natural progression for me to just do my own thing.
It wasn't long before she was invited to play the piano herself inside the house.
My parents were great. They neither pushed me into it or pushed me away, you know. When I got in from school, I'd just run into the room, shut the door, and just scream and play the piano and do anything I wanted, you know.
The piano is my instrument. That's the one I really play.
Do you write your songs on the piano?
Always, always with piano. I've never written a song without the piano. We write songs together. Yeah, he's my partner.
In 1972, aged 14, Kathy's family approached Ricky Hopper, a friend of theirs with music business connections, to see whether anyone was interested in publishing her songs.
And he was sort of acting as not a manager, but someone who was trying to break me through. And we made all sorts of rough demos on little tape recorders at home, about 20 songs per tape, you know, really boring, and sending them round to companies, and of course there was no reaction at all.
The result was more than disappointing. Companies that bothered to respond described her music as morbid, boring, and uncommercial. But Ricky Hopper wasn't giving up. He called an old friend of his from Cambridge University days.
He knew Dave very well.
Dave Gilmour, Pink Floyd's guitarist. After finishing their breakthrough album Metal, Gilmour was in good spirits and looking for young talent to record in his new home studio.
Which is an incredible thing for someone in that position to do, you know. He needn't have done anything like that. He's quite happy. He's got everything he needs. And he just went out of his way to help people, which without him, I just wouldn't be here, you know.
In 1973, the year Pink Floyd recorded Dark Side of the Moon, Dave Gilmour recorded and played guitar on Kate Bush's first studio session. The tapes were sent around, and again, there was no interest. Kate Bush went back to school and studied for the next 2 years. She was planning to become a psychiatrist. In 1975, Dave Gilmour gave Kate one final chance.
I mean, he put up the money for that, which no way could we have afforded, you know.
He paid for a full recording session in London's Air Studios, where they recorded three more songs, including The Man with the Child in His Eyes.
He's here again. The man with the child in his eyes.
It's really about, if you like, the knight in shining armour, and for the man, you know, the ideal woman that just doesn't exist. Couldn't possibly exist because it's fictional, and if that person did exist it wouldn't be any good anyway, because you don't want them to exist. It's that untouchable wonderfulness about someone who isn't real.
Soon after, while recording Wish You Were Here at Abbey Road, he played the tape to the manager of EMI's pop music division. Finally, there was interest, and a long series of negotiations started with the 17-year-old singer-songwriter. It would be 3 years before Kate's first song would be released.
And I was sort of hanging on every now and again, waiting for a phone call, you know, come in and make the album, come in and do this. You know, the sort of illusions that you get. And after a year, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to hang around anymore.
It was a changing and frustrating time, but Kate put it to good use.
And those 3 years were probably the most important years of my life, actually, because I had so much time. I had the money from the contract to be able to do the things I needed, like dance. I spent 5-6 hours a day working on the piano, trying to write songs.
She bought her own piano, passed a driving test on the second attempt, moved out of home, and studied dance with choreographer Lindsay Kemp, a former tutor for David Bowie.
I was looking through a Time Out, and there was this very small little caption that said, Lindsay Kemp is performing Flowers. And it just sounded great, you know, a play called Flowers. I didn't know what it was about. And I went along and it just absolutely blew me. And a couple of days later, by coincidence, I read that he was giving lessons.
She also formed her first group, the KT Bush Band, and played the pubs and clubs of London for 3 months, singing Rolling Stones, Creedence and Beatles covers, with the occasional original song. Finally, in August 1977, Kate got the phone call to say there was a studio ready. For her first album, 11 songs were recorded, with members of Cockney Rebel and Pilot as the backing band. Two of the Dave Gilmour demos were also included on the album, called The Kick Inside.
The Kick Inside is a baby inside the stomach.
A month later, Kate Bush was at odds with EMI over the single. She wanted Wuthering Heights and got her way.
I knew it had to be the first single. I just had a feeling. It had to be the one. And I thought, well, it'll either get somewhere or it won't do a thing. But I didn't expect it to do what it did. It was phenomenal.
How could you leave me when I needed to possess you? I hated you, I loved you too.
At the last moment, she changed the album artwork too. In the confusion, original copies accidentally found their way to radio stations, and Wuthering Heights got 2 months of airplay over Christmas before the first copies even appeared in the shops.
That's in a TV series years ago about Wuthering Heights, and I caught the very last few minutes of it. And I didn't know what it was, you know. There's this hand coming through the window and someone being grabbed and all this screaming and everything going on. And it stayed in my head for a long time because it was just fascinating. And I thought it would be really good subject matter for a song.
It was officially released in January 1978, going number one in England and Australia and knocking ABBA over for the position. More than 10 years later, Wuthering Heights' staying power was proven when it made the upper reaches of Triple J's Hottest 100 for 3 years running. The album The Kick Inside peaked at number three on both the British and Australian charts. With the success, no time was wasted in recording the second album. Lionheart was recorded in Nice, France, and by now, Kate had formed a steady relationship with her bassist and sound engineer, Del Palmer.
He's really great, actually, because he understands, you know, he sees that it's my work. I mean, I am what I am and what's happening is. And if he likes me, which he seems to do, which is great, then maybe he'll stay with me.
In October 1978, when Lionheart was finished, Kate stepped on a plane for Australia. It was her second visit here. In 1964, aged six, her family had quietly settled in Canberra, but returned to England soon after. It was different this time. The reception was enormous.
Australia was incredible. Fans that were so determined to get through to me that they'd actually ring up the hotel and pretend they were from EMI and get through to my hotel room. And in no other country in the world have fans been that enthusiastic. It was ridiculous. And they'd be waiting outside the hotel for me, and they were just so ardent.
On October the 11th, together with Leif Garrett, she co-hosted the King of Pop Awards in a circus tent in Melbourne to a TV audience of 2 million.
Have we got a show for you? This show tonight is going to make Ben Hur look like a B-grade movie. And to start it off, I have one of the loveliest ladies on the rock scene, international rock scene, Miss Kate Bush.
Hi.
Big cheer.
The next night, on Countdown, she performed the world television premiere of the new single.
Because this is great television, here is Kate Bush presenting her new single called, Leif?
It's called Hammer Horror.
Woo-hoo.
Kate had worked out the new dance steps only hours before in her hotel room. The early months of 1979 were spent preparing for a European tour, Kate's first live performances in her own right. A month before opening night, it had all sold out. Preparations were meticulous, with 17 costume changes and Peter Gabriel's lighting engineer, Bill Duffield, employed for special effects. After a successful warm-up show in Dorset, tragedy struck when Bill fell down a 17-foot hole in the auditorium. The death cast a shadow on a tour which deserved all the rave reviews it got across Europe. Kate Bush would never perform on this scale ever again. Work then began on the third album, Never Forever. Kate began spending time with Peter Gabriel, and the influence showed. She sang backing vocals on Games Without Frontiers. And Peter introduced her to the Australian-made Fairlight synthesizer, the grandfather of today's samplers. Never Forever was a change in sound and direction for Kate. The first single, Breathing, tackled the issue of nuclear war.
Gets inside, ooh, through her skin.
That's my little masterpiece that is terribly, terribly important to me, and I'm so proud of it. When I hear the backing track, without my voice or the actual words, and sometimes it just makes me want to cry because I think of how much effort the musicians that played on that track went to get what I was asking for. And it was so demanding because
such a heavy song, such a terribly negative subject matter if it's not looked at sensitively, that it was very hard for them, and eventually they just played it with all the emotion that it was lacking, and it just went pow.
But it was Babushka that put Kate Bush back in the limelight. It topped the charts in Australia.
Of course, she's very annoyed, and the break in the song is really her just throwing the restaurant at him. So there's like cutlery and got the eyes.
Because he actually is unfaithful.
Going straight across the room. No, he's not. He's not. He loves her very much. And the whole idea of the song is really the futility and the stupidness of humans, and how by our own thinking and swilling around in our own ideas, we come up with completely paranoid facts. So in her situation, she was in fact suspicious of a man who was doing nothing wrong. He loved her very much indeed.
At the end of 1980, she hosted a BBC radio show where she played her favourite songs. One was a Rolf Harris song, Sun Arise. It was a sign of things to come on the next album.
I've wanted to work with Rolf for like 2 or 3 years, because when I did the last album, I had an idea for doing a song all about Australia, which would have didgeridoos and all this
really?
Sort of thing.
What,
but,
for Never Forever?
Yes, but I just didn't have the time to actually sit down and write the song.
The Dreaming was 2 years in the making, and the title track featured Rolf on didgeridoo. But it was the single, Sat in Your Lap, with its extraordinary roller skating video that got the attention. Radio programmers in the UK found the songs too demanding and the album languished. Even Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys described the songs as very weird. But in America, things were different. The Dreaming made the top 10 album list on progressive music stations. It was 3 years before Kate's next release, The Hounds of Love. In that time, she built her own professional recording studio and spent 12 months uninterrupted on the project. The Hounds of Love was a concept album with one side entitled The Ninth Wave.
It's the idea of this person being in the water and they're absolutely terrified and they're completely alone at the mercy of their imagination. And the idea that they've got it in their head that they mustn't fall asleep, because if you fall asleep when you're in the water, I've heard that you roll over and so you drown. So they're trying to keep themselves awake.
But it was the singles that made it one of the most highly acclaimed albums of the 80s. Running Up That Hill was her first international success, making number 30 on the US Billboard charts.
I was trying to say that really a man and a woman can't understand each other, because we are a man and a woman, and if we could actually swap each other's roles, if we could actually be in each other's place for a while, I think we'd both be very surprised, and I think it would lead to a greater understanding. And really the only way I could think it could be done was either, you know, I thought a deal with the devil, you know, and I thought, well, no, why not a deal with God, you know, because in a way it's so much more powerful, the whole idea of asking God to make a deal with you. You see, for me, it is still called Deal with God. That was its title. But we were told that if we kept this title, that it wouldn't be played in any of the religious countries. So Italy wouldn't play it, France wouldn't play it, Australia wouldn't play it, Ireland wouldn't play it, and that generally we might get it blacked purely because it had God in the title. Now, I couldn't believe this. This seemed completely ridiculous to me, and the title was such a part of the song's entity. I just couldn't understand it. But nonetheless, although I was very unhappy about it, I felt unless I compromised that I was going to be cutting my own throat, you know. I just spent 2-3 years making an album, and we weren't going to get this record played on the radio if I was stubborn. So I felt I had to be grown up about this, so we changed it to Running Up That Hill. But it's always something I've regretted doing, I must say. And normally I always regret any compromises that I make.
Surprisingly, MTV found the video too erotic and played a mime TV performance instead. The second single, Cloud Busting, featured a sensational video with actor Donald Sutherland.
I'm a big fan of him as an actor, and he really was perfect for the part.
And a rainmaking machine designed by H.R. Geiger of Alien fame. In 1986, Kate appeared live on Comic Relief singing Breathing and performing a duet with Rowan Atkinson of a song called Do Bears Shit in the Woods. It was also the year of a big duet with Peter Gabriel, Don't Give Up.
Don't give up, I know you can make it good.
Though I saw it all around.
The sixth album was another 3 years in the making.
The more I work on an album, the more I think it's actually the process for me to try and heal myself, have a look at myself. Do you know what I mean? Actually a very selfish thing in a way, but I think art is.
In that time, her interest in world affairs broadened. She endorsed a vegetarian campaign and worked for the Counter-Aid Project in Britain. In New York, she appeared with Peter Gabriel at the United Nations in a plea to preserve the world's rainforests. The influence was felt in the 1989 release, The Sensual World. It combined Irish traditional music with the sounds of Bulgarian women's folk music.
They're three of the greatest female singers in Bulgaria, and they've been singing together for 20 to 30 years.
1992 saw Kate's return to the charts with the unlikeliest of songs.
I was such a big fan of Elton's when I was little. I really loved his stuff. He was my biggest hero, really. And one of my favourite songs of his was Rocketman.
With her permission, 1992 also saw Kate's voice appear in dance clubs with Utah Saints' song, Something Good. In late 1993, her seventh album was released, this time 4 years in the making. The Red Shoes is based on Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale about a pair of shoes that won't stop dancing. A 50-minute dance film, The Line, The Cross, The Curve, was made to accompany the release. With almost 20 years in the music business, Kate Bush has stood up to critics and produced an extraordinary body of work on her own terms. Commercial success has eluded her many times, but it has never been her goal. As a creative artist, she continues to challenge and inspire her dedicated fans.
The J-Files. Well, now Kate's been in the biz for 40 years. When this was made, she'd released 7 of her 10 albums. She took a little bit of a break from music at this point to raise her son, but she returned in 2005 with her first album in 12 years. And true to form, she was back on the charts with her first top 10 in nearly 20 years. Here's some of your favourite musicians talking about how Kate Bush has inspired them. This is Esti from Hive.
I've only heard a little bit of Bulgarian Women's Choir because years ago Kate Bush put out a record which used a lot of Bulgarian singers on it. Yeah.
That was like a huge influence on me when I was at UCLA. She's so cool. We love Kate Bush.
Yeah, so right, so you heard that record too.
That record is burnt to a crisp. I played it so much.
Hayley from the Jezebels.
As a front woman, sometimes you can either go, I'm going to be really masculine about this and get like really tough and kind of take on a masculine tradition of front person. But I think Kate Bush was amazing for being so inherently feminine and still really strong.
This is Alstra.
My mother actually named me after Kate Bush because she was such a huge Kate Bush fan. I definitely feel like a strong connection to the music that she was making and like her aesthetic for sure.
We won't run, we can fight. All that keeps us up at night.
There Sarah Blasco.
I think what I love about her is the eccentricity of what she does, but also there's real heart, there's real genuineness and a purity to what she does as a performer and as a writer. She's just following her muse. She doesn't care how she looks or what she's, you know, how crazy it is what she's doing. I don't think she has a concept of that. She just does what she feels, and I really admire that.
All right, that's it from me. As always, you can get in touch via the Double J Facebook page. You can leave a review on the podcast and let me know what you think. If you like it, tell a friend, share it about. I'm Gemma Pike. I'll leave you with our new favourite thing to do, your thoughts on the legendary Kate Bush.
Hey, this is Mel. I'm a huge fan of Kate Bush because of how epic her songs and music videos are. I've lost count of the amount of injuries I've sustained from trying to replicate her awesome moves late on a Saturday night.
Hey, this is Rachel from Newcastle. I just adore Kate Bush. I have really fond, beautiful memories of being about 6 or 7 and my mum playing the Wuthering Heights clip, like seeing it on TV. And it was just beautiful. It was this gorgeous lady in her red dress dancing through the English countryside. It was outstanding.
Hi, this is Shane from Canberra and I love Kate Bush. As a kid growing up in country New South Wales, liking Kate Bush was absolutely scary, but it was absolutely rewarding because her music is just unlike anything else you heard through the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s and today.
Hi, it's Pip from Hobart. Oh, Kate Bush, I found her so appealing when I was a younger woman because of her eccentricity and her unique vocal styles and her dance moves. Love her or hate her, you've got to agree that she was or is an exceptional artist.
The J-Files.